We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
In the late 1980s, Yucca Mountain in Nevada was picked to be the site for permanent storage of the nation's high-level radioactive waste. And here we're talking about material, mostly spent fuel, that came out of nuclear reactors that are used to generate electricity. Technical problems and considerable opposition, however, from the people of Nevada made it seem over time increasingly unlikely that that site would ever open. And recently, back in the spring, the Obama administration said that Yucca Mountain was not an option and cut funding for the project. Things seem a little bit uncertain, but clear that we still have a problem. And this morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about a new plan that's being proposed. Has been proposed by a group of experts on nuclear waste policy. And this really came out of a workshop that was organized this past spring by people who are associated with the program in arms control, disarmament, and international security here at the U of I. It brought academics from universities all around the Midwest to talk about this problem, the spent fuel storage problem. And they produced a report that's titled Plan D for Spent Nuclear Fuel. And if you would like to read it, you can either get a hard copy or you can go to the website of ACTIS, the program Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security, and you can read it. Here to talk about it with us this morning is Cliff Singer. He's professor in the Department of Nuclear, Plasma, and Radiological Engineering here at the University of Illinois, one of the contributors to the report. Questions are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. We'll pay for the call, 800-222-9455. Questions are welcome. We do ask people to try to be brief, but anyone is certainly welcome to call. And thank you very much for being here.
It's a pleasure.
We could probably spend a long time just talking about the tangled history of Yucca Mountain. Maybe, though, to start, you could talk a little bit about how it is that, even though some other potential sites were discussed, that it seemed fairly early on here, Yucca Mountain was the place that was people were concentrating on, people in the government, people in DOE were concentrating on as the place to store this material.
That was essentially a political decision. There was a compromise made due to following a long impasse on this topic over the 1960s and 1970s. In 1982, it was decided that a first waste disposal site would be located to bury the waste forever without reusing it. And that would happen in Nevada, but it would be limited to 70,000 tons, which seemed like a lot at the time of spent fuel. But it turns out that's the amount of fuel that has been produced up till about now. And so, and the second repository was supposed to go east of the Mississippi River. It's not in the legislation, but that was the understanding at the time. Mm-hmm. Well, we can't even get the first repository sited in one of the least populated states in the country, or at least was one of the least populated states in the country in the 1980s. And the chances of getting one sited east of the Mississippi are virtually zero. And so this was a political decision, not a technical decision. I mean, there are some advantages to the Yucca Mountain site. There's some technical disadvantages to it. But the reason it got there was not a technical decision. It was a political decision.
Well, then, is the reason that it was abandoned also a political decision? I know some people would say that it was, and it has a lot to do with the fact that Harry Reid, senator from Nevada, became the majority leader in the Senate. We have a Democratic president in Washington now. And the people in Nevada, it seemed most of the people in Nevada never wanted this in Nevada.
Well, it's a combination of political and technical questions. Yes, it's the essential problem is this is a approximately $90 billion project, and Nevada gets less than 0.1% of that amount of money. You compare that to Alaska, for example, where billions of dollars of oil is taken out of the ground, and every person in Alaska gets $1,000 a year in compensation for whatever environmental damage there is. And so it's hardly surprising that the people in Nevada as a whole, not all of them, but many of them, have decided to oppose this, and that one of them happens to be the majority leader in the Senate is no coincidence that it's running into problems now. But there are also technical problems, which I can talk about.
Okay. Well, that, I suppose, in a way, the question is moot, but I'm prompted to ask the question, well, actually, do you think if the government had offered Nevada a better deal, there might have been more willingness to be the host for the site?
That's speculative, but it certainly makes sense, yes.
Well, then going to the technical question, because I think actually some people also have reservations about the site, about the technical suitability of the mm-hmm. site itself. What can you say about that?
Well, Yucca Mountain is a ridge, and that means you can tunnel into it horizontally. And it's volcanic tuff, which is a soft rock, and so it's easy to tunnel. And it's a very dry area. So those were three advantages of going to Yucca Mountain. It seemed like an easier place to go from actually doing it. But it's also an environment which will have oxygen in it for millions of years. And that means that there's a potential for corrosion of the containers. And one of the most serious technical problem is there's a plan to put shields, water shields, over top of the canisters after 100 years when the site's been radioactive, highly radioactive for 100 years. And these are titanium-palladium alloy shields. And there's some technical question of whether that part of the plan is actually realizable.
That would actually involve going in there and working in an atmosphere where the radiation levels were very high.
That's right. But by contrast, the Swedes and the Finns are using an environment that doesn't have oxygen in it and casing things in copper. And in that environment, copper is stable for millions of years, so there's no problem with corrosion. The containers are more expensive, but the overall engineering problem is much simpler.
Uh-huh. How much money has been spent to date on Yucca Mountain, developing the site?
It's on the order of $10 billion.
And that was where did that money come from?
That money is appropriated by Congress. It comes in principle from the 1 cent per kilowatt hour or $1 per megawatt hour that we all pay on our electricity bills. But in practice, that money just disappears into the Treasury, mm-hmm. and Congress appropriates it or not as it feels fit. And so really, it's just appropriations from Congress.
Well, and that's one of the issues that I know that you have something to say about, because I think what you and the other people associated with the report are arguing, that in fact that money should continue to be collected, but what it should be, it should actually then go, though, into a dedicated sort of account, in a sense, so that, in fact, that sooner or later does end up going to pay for what it's supposed to pay for?
That's right. And industry is also increasingly saying, why are the ratepayers putting all this money away and getting nothing for it? Maybe it should just be held in escrow until the time comes to actually deal with the problem. And that is actually the way we deal with decommissioning the reactor vessels. That originally it was understood that that would take 60 years and you had to prescribe ahead of time. There would be a revenue source for that. And it looks like the spent fuel management problem is turning into the same thing. That is, it's probably going to be there in many cases until the reactors disappear. And so there's a lot to be said for using the same mechanism that's already functioning for decommissioning, for also dealing with the spent fuel.
Some people actually think that that money should be refunded to ratepayers.
Well, if it were set up in escrow funds, then what would happen is that you'd take the amount of money needed to do it at the time it happens, and the rest would be go back to the utilities, which are regulated, which then the state regulatory bodies could force them to give that money back to the ratepayers.
Uh-huh. And I guess one other – I have a caller here we'll get to in a second, but maybe one other thing we want to make sure we should mention here is that the material that we're talking about, the waste material, currently – is being stored on site at the plants where it's been generated.
That's right, almost all of it.
And what now? Here, obviously, I'm sure that the utility companies are. Their complaint to the federal government is: you said that you would take this. We're still having to deal with it. This is costing us money. You have broken your promise, and you're responsible. So, you know, how much has the industry, the utility industry, how much money do you think that it has paid out dealing with the expenses of dealing with this stuff?
Well, the ratepayers actually pay it. I mean, you and I pay it directly into the fund. What's happening is the utilities are just suing the government. case by case for the old fuel. And then when new fuel accumulates, they have to sue the government again. Mm. And the lawyers get 30% of that money, at least they have in the past. And there's $11 billion worth of liability out there. So the lawyers are going to walk off with billions of dollars for doing something that for sorting out a problem that the government should sort out without paying any legal fees.
So that really, again, at one of the costs of not having a solution is that money is being spent on litigation because it's continuing to sit and the utility companies are suing the government over that and money is being paid out. And as you say, probably most of it ends up in the pockets of the lawyers.
Well, not most of it, about 30%. But yeah, and so, I mean, the utilities don't actually pay for this. Ultimately, they recover the money from the government. Yeah. But it's appropriated from the Department of Justice budget rather than the Department of Energy budget. And so the people who are supposed to are not solving the problem get no penalty for not doing it. It's the Department of Justice and the congressional committees that appropriate money for the Department of Justice that end up forking out the money. And so there's a disconnect between who pays the bills and who's not doing the job.
We've known for a long time now, at least going back to the late 50s, that we had this problem and that we needed to have some sort of long-term solution. Why now, all these years later, do we still not have a solution, particularly after having paid all this money out, we developed this place, now it's kind of in limbo, but it seems, at least from what I read, unlikely that it will open.
Why are the chickens now coming home to roost, right?
why after all of these years do we still not have a solution to this?
Well, this is why this report's called Plan D, right? So Plan A was we were going to make lots more plutonium, and it turned out there was lots of uranium in the world, and so we didn't need to do that. Mm-hmm. Plan B was Yucca Mountain. We were going to bury it forever. But as I mentioned earlier, the idea of opening up a second depository maybe east of the Mississippi River, which was the Department of Energy was supposed to start working on this year, turned out to be politically impossible. And that took many years until about now to figure out. And so the Bush administration, a previous administration, had this Plan C where they were going to take all this stuff and put it in liquid sodium-cooled reactors and burn it three times so it would all fit in Yucca Mountain. And that turns out to be enormously expensive and has been... Well, it's still being considered, but it's not the preferred option right now. And it takes about 15 years to work through each of these oopses and 10 or 15 years. And so that's how it took so long to get to where we are.
Yeah. And so the long and the short of it is that your proposal, at least for the moment, is simply to leave it where it is now.
Yes. It turns out that... at a nuclear reactor site, there is the nuclear fuel that's in the core, which, if you're not careful, can cause a real disaster, like in Three Mile Island, a financial disaster anyway. And then it goes out and goes underwater. And those storage pools, if you drain them, they will catch fire and all, and they're not in a containment building. And so that has to be managed very carefully. The additional hazard in a secure site like that of putting it in these dry casks that a freight train can run into without breaking them is negligible. So that the bottom line is, if you're comfortable having a nuclear reactor near you, then you should be comfortable having the spent fuel in these concrete casks. If you're not comfortable having a nuclear reactor near you, then you think it shouldn't be there. It's not a question of whether the additional spent fuel should be there.
Mm-hmm. So the idea would be to encase it in the way that it would have been encased if you were taking it to Yucca Mountain, but so do that.
Right.
But then just leave it sitting there.
Yeah.
In storage at
where it becomes safer and safer as time goes on, because the dominant long-lived radioactive isotopes that are a problem with respect to shipping and so forth have a half-life of 30 years. So if you leave it there until the plant is decommissioned, anywhere from half to three-quarters of the problem has already gone away before you have to deal with it.
Right. We have a couple of callers here. Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Clifford Singer. He's professor in the Department of Nuclear, Plasma, and Radiological Engineering at the University of Illinois. We're talking about the problem of waste storage, high-level nuclear waste. The material that's basically we're talking about here, spent fuel that's produced by nuclear reactors that are used to generate electricity. And some of what you will find here, what we're talking about here this morning, you will find in a report recently put out, and Cliff is one of the contributors. The title is Plan D for Spent Nuclear Fuel. And if you want to read it, you can go to the website of the Program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security on the U of I campus. We have several callers here. Let's go to Belgium first, line four. Hello.
Hello. If I might take a moment to explain how I understand this works, I'll ask a question here. Now, we start off and we mine uranium in some place in the world. We refine that down to a material that is energetic enough to work in a nuclear reactor. We use the material in a nuclear reactor until the point it's not energetic enough to produce electricity for us. Then we take and haul it off someplace. But when we haul it off someplace, it's still so energetic that it's dangerous to us. Why, and here comes the question, I'm not very smart on this, so why can't we re-refine that stuff, get it into a state that is more energetic, put it back in the refiner, into the reactor, take more power out of it, and keep doing this over and over until the material that's left is harmless?
Well, there are two approaches to that. One is to just do it once, which is more expensive than just mining uranium. The problem with that, and put it in back in the regular reactors, the problem with that is that there's an isotope that builds up. It's called americium-241. It sounds exotic, but it's actually in your home in your smoke detector in small amounts. And that has a half-life of 430 years. And it's the problem is you build up more of that as you go through one of those cycles. And so the essential problem, which is the heat generated that you have to contain when you put it in the ground, doesn't get solved. So the only way to do what you're talking about is to use it over and over again in special reactors, which nobody has ever gotten to work well. And so right now we don't have that solution in hand.
So you couldn't take this material that keeps building up that still is energetic enough to cause some problems. You can't keep putting that back in the reactor and sucking the energy off of it to keep making electricity for us.
It's theoretically possible, but it's far more expensive than simply letting it sit in a can and letting people decide maybe 100 years from now whether or not to do that with the better technology that's likely to be available then.
But you just said that the cost of this is going up enormously every year. At some point, it seems to me it's going to be more expensive for that than it will be for the refining.
Well, we've done quantitative studies of this, and it looks like that's not going to happen for at least 100 years, as far as we can tell.
I see. Thank you very much.
All right. On to somebody on a cell phone here. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I kind of agree with that gentleman earlier, too. We got to do something besides sticking in somebody else's backyard, quite frankly. Most public would tell you, don't in my backyard. And I come from that area back there in the southwest, Yucca Mountain area, and they're very adamant. They're very, you know, they don't want it there, and they never asked for it in the first place. The point seems to be, and everybody wants to go to the nuclear reactor scenario where we've got all our power plants running on nuclear power, and they say it's clean. Sure, it might be clean burning or clean running, but it's not clean because what do you do with the after effects, like this gentleman earlier said? We got to figure out a way, and I know it's expensive. I mean, it's the same thing with autos right now. We're trying to figure out a cheaper and a more efficient way to run an automobile without burning fossil fuels. So we got to start somewhere. We can't just say, no, it's too expensive. Yeah, eventually, you know, it's going to come down. It's like anything else out there. We can't say no. We got to look at this in a good way. If we're going to live on planet Earth, we got to stop polluting it. And to me, that is one of the most major pollutants in this country. People tend to forget how much we pollute it with this. I know for a fact in California they got stuff sitting around in yards, and they've shown pictures of it. Just barrels on top of barrels on top of barrels of stuff just leaking out, leaching everywhere. So where do you think that goes? I mean, it's kind of unfair to the people in general where you have these reactors that if you can't take care of it on site, then don't build them. That's just my comment. Thanks.
Well, one thing I guess I think it's a probably important point to make is that because I'm sure this will get connected in people's minds to the debate over whether we should or should not have nuclear electricity generation. That is quite aside from that point. If all of the nuclear power plants, if we just turned them all off today, we still have this product that we have to do something with. And in fact, I think it's true, and you can tell me, that even if we opened up Yucca Mountain, it would, everything that we have right, it would essentially fill up Yucca Mountain with everything we have now that's sitting around and all the power plants.
Right, at least the legal limits on Yucca Mountain. Physically, it could probably accommodate twice as much that political compromise was that. But nevertheless, if we do just rebuild on site all the reactors we have without even expanding nuclear energy generation in the global warming age, we will still generate more over the century than Yucca Mountain can hold. And so something else needs to be done. I think the essential thing to keep in mind is when somebody said, the previous caller said, we have to do something about it. Who is the we, right? What we need to do right now is to find a safe way of handling this stuff on site, because in fact, we're not going to do anything else with it for at least 20 years. Mm-hmm. What future generations are going to have to decide is whether it's actually worth reprocessing, or they should simply take the approach that, like the Swedes and the Finns have done, and safely stick it in the ground essentially forever.
Yeah. And do you believe that it is that the technology we have for storing the material, it is possible to store it safely?
It is possible to store it safely. It is being stored safely. Mm. It is possible to dispose of it safely. What we don't know is whether future generations will decide to do that or to actually reuse the material. And I don't think that it's appropriate for us to try to make a decision for what people are going to do 100 years from now. I wrote a book, and I quoted there, Robert Louis Stevenson went over and talked to Napoleon and tried to sell him a steam-powered submarine. And Napoleon's minister, Talleyrand, said, an interesting conversationalist, but he's a bit cracked, and sent him packing. And it was a good thing, because he came back and built the Clermont and revolutionized transportation. So he should apply the talents of the day to the problems of the day, not to the problems mm-hmm. that won't come up for another 100 years. As it turned out, submarines didn't.
So you would say that it would make sense to store the material safely, but not in a way that would make it irretrievable?
Right. Keep the option open for future generations. First, store it safely. Mm-hmm. Set up a procedure for making a decision when the time comes for which way to go. But future generations are, in fact, going to make that decision, and there's no use pretending that we can make it for them.
Right. Let's talk with some other folks here. We have a couple of Urbana callers, and the next is line two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Line two?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, hi. Professor Singer, you mentioned earlier that if one is comfortable living in the vicinity of an operating nuclear reactor, you should feel comfortable with the stored waste because it's much less dangerous. And I heard an interview with a fellow called, I think his name is Mangano. Yeah, Joseph Mangano on Living on Earth, the last episode, pretty interesting, where they did a study, and he has a book out called, Radioactive Baby Teeth, where they got these baby teeth, and they looked at the concentrations of strontium-90 in it, and they found people who are living next to nuclear plants have a higher level of strontium, and they have much higher rates of all types of cancer. And he was saying, particularly for older nuclear plants, and I was really surprised by this because I didn't know that nuclear plants routinely let off radioactive materials into the atmosphere. So my question is, do you know of this research and the health risks of living near a nuclear plant, and what's the deal with routine releasing of radioactive materials in the operation of these plants?
People my age, I'm 60 years old, all have strontium-90 in our teeth. It comes from atmospheric testing back in the early days of the Cold War. That's the dominant source of strontium-90 in baby teeth. And there are releases from power plants, but the strontium-90 is carefully contained in the radioactive canisters. The releases are gaseous materials that are not strontium-90. As far as the controversy over cancer rates around various facilities, not just nuclear power plants, this is a complicated issue. And it depends where the plants are, too. If they're in the United States, they've been tightly regulated for a long time. If they're in the Soviet Union, it can be a different story. And so in any case, the problem does not come once the waste is stuck in these dry casks and tightly contained. All the radiation, there are no expected radiation releases from the casks. If there are problems, the problems come earlier. So it comes back to what I was saying before. If you're comfortable living next to a nuclear power plant, you should be comfortable living with the dry cask storage of the spent nuclear fuel once it's put into those casks. If you're not comfortable living to a nuclear power plant, that's not the problem. The problem is the other operations in the plant, if there is a problem.
But this suggests that no one should be comfortable living next to a plant. So you're saying that no strontium-90 is released in the atmosphere in the normal operation of nuclear plants in the U.S.?
I don't know if it's no strontium 90, but the dominant releases are of more volatile materials. The problem is that every way of making energy produces some sort of environmental damage. You know, whether it's mercury from coal-fired power plants or nitrogen oxides from gas-fired power plants or toxic materials used in making solar materials. So this is a question of balance, and I'm actually not here to either defend or not defend nuclear power. I'm really here to talk about ways of dealing, as David said, with the problem that we already have and have to manage, which is we've already made a lot of this stuff. And the reality is that we're going to continue making a fair amount of more of it until there's some less than until there's some major breakthrough in other ways of making electricity.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll go to another Urbana caller. This is line 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Just to follow up on the previous caller, I myself would be a little more concerned living downwind from a coal-fired power plant than I would be a nuclear plant because of the stuff that comes out of those things. Anything but nice. The reason I call those, I read a very interesting article 9-10 years ago about a technology called pebble bed reactors, which if you know anything about that, I'd like to, you know, if you got any updates on that or know anything about that, I'd be interested to know about that. One of the virtues of the pebble bed technology was that the nuclear pellets, the fissionable pellets were already, they would have been in their manufacturing process were to be coated with a corrosion and heat resistant alloy that therefore made their handling and storage and for that matter, the ability then to bury them automatically built in because the coatings on the outside of the pellets would supposedly resist anything and so on and so forth. So if you could speak to that issue, and that's one of the virtues of the pebble bed technology was the fact that the waste disposal was considered to be somewhat easier and more straightforward. So if you could speak to that issue and what you know about it, and I'd be happy to hear that. Thank you.
All right.
The pebble bed reactor is being developed in South Africa. When they gave up their nuclear weapons program, they had a lot of nuclear technologists and turned to that. And we almost got one at Clinton, actually, because there's a hole in the ground there that the second plant in Clinton never went to. And they have advantages. The primary advantage is that a pebble bed reactor can't melt down. It's got so much mass compared to the amount of fuel in those pellets that it can take all of the decay heat and heat up and cool down without ever having to be cooled and still not melt down. The waste disposal advantages are probably minimal compared to that. The essential disadvantage is the same story, which is there's so much mass in there that the power density is much lower. And so the cost of those plants is likely to be considerably higher than the conventional nuclear power plant. Mm.
It has been a long time, I think, sometimes since the 70s, since a new plant has essentially been – someone has undertaken to build a new nuclear power plant, right?
Yes. Well, ones were planned in the 70s and completed in the decade after that. There are a large number of plans that have now been submitted to build nuclear power plants, albeit not in Illinois or California and several other states which prohibit the construction of nuclear power plants until there's a solution to the waste problem.
Well, that's the question that I was going for was just that. I don't really want to turn into a debate of is nuclear power good or bad, but to what extent the fact that we do not have a permanent solution for the waste problem, is that an important impediment to developing new plants?
It is. Well, particularly in California, Illinois, Connecticut, several other states, and Wisconsin, our neighbor, you simply can't do it. So when the operating licenses for all the plants that supply all the power to Chicago and here terminate, then unless this problem has been solved by then, which is 20 or 30 years from now, then there's going to be a serious problem with where the electricity is going to come from. So, yes, it is in the way. And more generally, the uncertainty is making the industry nervous about investing. And it just adds to the general uncertainty about whether nuclear power is going to pay, and it makes the industry nervous about investing in nuclear power plants. It's either a good thing or a bad thing, depending on whether you think nuclear power is a good thing or a bad thing.
Well, all right. Other callers here. Let's go next to Normal, line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yes. I recall reading a lot of articles about how France has a great deal of nuclear power. I wonder what they do to store their waste.
Well, France takes this first approach to reusing that I talked about, which is to reprocess it once, put it back in the same kind of reactors. And they say that that reduces the volume of the high-level spent, high-level radioactive waste, which it does, but it doesn't reduce this heat load problem that I was talking about. And so what the French have done is basically found a very expensive way of kicking the can down the road. Well, the can is sitting in front of them in the road now because this material is starting to come out of the nuclear reactors, and they really don't have a viable plan for dealing with it.
They don't know what they're going to do then.
Yeah, well, they have a voluntary siting process.
Mm-hmm.
If you ever watch the French truckers on the television sitting on the roads when something happens they don't like, you can imagine how difficult it may be to do a voluntary siting in France. It might happen. But they also have a plan in theory to build these liquid sodium-cooled reactors. They built the world's largest. It ran 10% of the time and cost over $1 billion to decommission. So in principle, they're going to do that another 10 or 20 years, but time will tell if they actually manage it. Okay. They're a long way from having an integrated solution to the waste management problem.
Well, is there any country in the world that has a good solution that might help our country?
Well, as I said, Sweden and Finland have found a way of burying the material in granite, which conducts heat well, and so you can pack a lot in, twice as much in there as you would in Yucca Mountain, and in copper containers in this non-oxygen environment that will last forever. So they're demonstrating that there is a way to do it. The question is, in many people's minds, if this stuff becomes valuable in 100 years or 200 years to dig up and use again anyway, what's the point of now spending all the money to isolate it forever? And so one of our options that's suggested in the Plan D report is that we prepare the groundwork, identify the sites for doing that sort of thing, but don't actually spend all the money on it until we're clear that our future generations are clear that that's the best way to go.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And when you talk about the fact that the spent fuel is hot, you're talking about not radioactive hot, but hot temperature hot.
Right, hot like generates a lot of waste heat, right.
Yeah, and what sort of temperatures are we talking about?
Well, you have to keep it below the boiling point of water if you put it in Yucca Mountain, because once it gets near the boiling point of water, it fractures the rock and mobilizes the moisture that you're trying to keep away from the fuel. Mm. So the answer is hot needs to be less than 100 degrees centigrade.
How long does that does it continue to be that hot?
Well, the plan is to seal Yucca Mountain after 300 years.
Okay. And again, to another caller here, Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. Yucca has also got the seismic problem. It's the most seismically active area of the U.S., I guess. But what I wanted to mention in the call about France, there's just been an expose that they've been shipping some of their quote-unquote waste. They're claiming that it's possible that the Russians can recycle it, but it's apparently just sitting in pits in a parking lot in Siberia. So, it just illustrates the point you just made is that they don't have any solution either, and they're pointed at a lot as a good example of why we should have a nuclear future. I still think that the lost opportunities that represented by your activity in having to deal with all this stuff is, which I guess, frankly, when one has to figure out what to do with it, but the idea of building a pebble bed reactor without a containment vessel because it's so safe and all that is, if all that energy was put into energy savings and new technologies and perhaps better transmission lines for the electricity we are using would be much better spent. So that's not a question. Thanks.
Well, the pebble bed reactors would not be built without containments in this country. And it's an operational question of what happens if you have a loss of coolant inside the containment. And just a comment, to be fair to the Yucca Mountain designers, there is an old fault there. They're staying away from that. The most dangerous earthquake region in the world is probably near here in the New Madrid Fault, which goes boom every few hundred years, and we're not prepared for. So there's one place you don't want to put a radioactive waste dump.
So someone here calling on a cell phone in Champaign, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
A person who works in the nuclear industry suggested that an obvious solution to the waste problem was to store it or place it in the mines where the material came from originally. Did you look at that option, and why did you not use it? Thank you.
Well, that's an option, but it's not the best option. Not every uranium mine is in a geological area that's safe from leaching. And also, there's a much larger array of chemical... There's a much broader array of chemical composition in the materials that are made in a nuclear reactor than there is in the original uranium. There's an isotope, technetium in particular, has a long half-life and is more prone to be soluble in water. So you don't necessarily want to use the same geology for the uranium, for the disposal as was in the uranium mine in the first place. Although the material itself becomes less radioactive overall than the uranium ore was after about 10,000 years, even though we're planning to isolate it for a million years.
Urbana, next line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I recall, and forgive me, I didn't hear the beginning of the show. You may have already covered this. I recall reading years ago about the French using vitrification. Whatever happened to that?
Well, we were talking about the high-level radioactive materials. That is, when the French reprocess it, they produce two things. They produce plutonium, which we talked about. They process back into reactors. And then there's all the atom split products, the fission products, which they have to do something with, and they're trying to vitrify them. They've got a lot of it still stored in liquid form in waste tanks, and their vitrification program is sort of working, but it's not working as well as one might hope. But if you reprocess, one trouble with reprocessing, it generates large volumes of liquid wastes. And those liquid wastes, handling those liquid wastes is potentially accident prone, and particularly in the reprocessing facility. They've had problems with that in Britain. And they're worried about it in Japan. They're not starting up as fast as they would hope because of concerns about that. So that just generates a whole set of complications for which there are technical solutions, but they don't always work.
Thank you.
All right. We have about 12, 13 minutes left, perhaps, in this part of Focus 580. And let me introduce again our guest, Clifford Singer. He's professor in the Department of Nuclear, Plasma, and Radiological Engineering at University of Illinois. And he is one of the contributors to a report that came out from the program here in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security. It was something that really came out of a workshop that they did back in the spring to try to bring together people who have expertise in the field dealing with nuclear waste to ask this question, well, what are we going to do with spent nuclear fuel, highly radioactive material that is the result of generating using nuclear reactors to make electricity? The plan for a long time was to store it in Nevada at a place called Yucca Mountain. And now the Obama administration, says that this is not going to happen, and they have cut off funding for it. And the question is now, all right, what are we going to do now? And the report here, we're talking about Plan D for spent nuclear fuel, which you can read on the website of the program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security, makes some proposals. And our guest here this morning was one of the contributors. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, one thing I want to come back to here for just a second is the status of Yucca Mountain, because, and we were talking a little bit about this actually before we got going, that the funding has been cut off, but the Congress has apparently not officially said, all right, we're closing the door on this. So that I found that kind of confusing. So what exactly is the status of Yucca Mountain?
The status of Yucca Mountain is this. The Nuclear Waste Policy Act of 1982 requires that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission review the Yucca Mountain site application, which has been submitted to it. They have about a year to just collect all the paperwork, and then, in principle, another 3 years, given enough money, to complete the review. How fast they complete that review depends on the level of funding that Congress supplies. I mean, the administration made a proposal to cut the funding, and Congress has done that, but it's really up to Congress to appropriate the money. And so the Congress is not appropriating enough money to get that review to happen in 3 years. But the process is still supposed to be going on under the law. So until the law is changed, Yucca Mountain is not quite dead. It could be a phoenix. It could resurrect.
I guess that was one of my questions. Is it possible that sometime in the future, then maybe a future administration would say, oh, well, you know, actually, we really need this, and I think we ought to go back to Plan B. Was that right?
Plan B, right?
right. Plan B. We're going to go back to Plan B for Barry. Yeah, Plan B for Barry, and take as much. And at that point, no doubt they would have to say, we actually have to enlarge Yucca Mountain because there's not enough. We have to build more storage because we have more stuff. Could that happen?
Yes, that's an option. I mean, it wouldn't necessarily have to wait for a new administration. The next Congress in 2012 could decide that that's what they want to do because they appropriate the money. The administration is legally obligated to spend it. They can drag their feet, but basically they have to do it. So, yes, that's a possibility, and they could enlarge the capacity of Yucca Mountain. That, however, is much more difficult. The legislation that now stands has extraordinary barriers to keep a filibuster from happening, to stop Yucca Mountain approval. It really has to sail through the Senate and the House on an up-and-down fifth majority vote. However, to expand the capacity of Yucca Mountain would almost certainly take 60 votes in the Senate and would be much harder to do because the protection for getting that kind of legislation through Congress is not written into the law.
Yeah. And again, back to callers in Urbana. Line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. This is interesting. I have a question. Whether you bury it or use Yucca Mountain, what about global warming? What's the effect that's going to have? And if it does have any effect in the future, what's going to happen to those materials?
Well, the global warming debate has had a lot of influence on the attitude of people towards nuclear power. You see the increasing support for nuclear power in this country, and also in the technical community, particularly the arms control community, which used to be very skeptical of nuclear power, you're now finding that most of those people have accepted the inevitability that we will continue using a fair amount of nuclear power, at least for the next few decades, because it's the most practical alternative to coal for making electricity. It's what's called baseload power, that is power plants that run all the time on fairly cheap fuel. The other way to go is to use natural gas, but that's an expensive fuel and is mostly used for peak power, that is during the daytime and summer when you have air conditioning. So certainly the climate change debate has partly tipped the balance on the way some people, a sizable number of people, actually look at nuclear energy. And so all of that makes the imperative for coming up with a sensible way of managing the waste we have and the waste that we will generate over the next few decades even more important.
One of the other reasons, I think, that people have for wanting to get this material out of the power plants where it's being stored now into some central location is the matter of security. And they say, well, we can better guard it to make sure that nothing happens to it. Mm-hmm. What about the concerns about the security concerns that I would imagine that the utilities would say they have about being able to protect the material if it's going to stay there where it is?
Well, again, all the waste goes into wet pool storage, underwater storage, and if those tanks drain the way they were originally designed, it would take 3 or 4 days for them to catch fire and spew the radiation all over the place. Mm-hmm. But since they don't know if they need to put it in dry cask storage, they're starting to double rack it, that is to put twice as much waste in the wet pool storage. And so under those conditions, the fuel will catch fire in a few hours if it's uncovered. So you're actually, given those two choices, you're better off telling the utilities, no, we're really going to have you store this in dry casks on site and stop doing this double racking. Not that that's enormously dangerous, but it's safer to put it in the dry cask storage than in the wet pool storage. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission may end up reviewing the standards for storing dry casks, because it would be desirable to have a protective berm around them so at least nobody can fly an airplane into them or launch, not just a little grenade wouldn't even do it, but, you know, launch a major rocket at it and hit it easily. So That's desirable. It's not essential. They're being operated safely without that. But if they're really going to, if we're going to realize that they're going to stay there for many decades, then there's a chance that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission will in fact take a look at that issue. And nevertheless, that has to be done somewhere. And then there's, of course, the question of transporting it everywhere when it's highly radioactive. Mm-hmm. So there's a trade-off between leaving well enough alone, leaving where it is, where it can be safely managed, and trying to collect it into central location. And it's really only in those seven or eight plants that are shut down where you don't have to pay for all, otherwise don't have to pay for all the security for storing the other fuel on site, where it is really pretty advantageous to move it off site. Although that material could go to other nuclear reactors, it doesn't have to go to a central site, although it could do.
Okay. Someone here in Champaign on the cell phone, line 3. Hello. Is there a caller there, line 3? Perhaps not. And if I kept them waiting too long, I apologize. We have about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580-333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, what if we say that the fuel that's being stored now at the power plants, and it's in these pools of water, that what we're going to do is we're going to put that into the dry casks, the things that would have been sent to or would have ended up in Yucca Mountain. Mm-hmm. Does that now, though, mean that at every nuclear power plant or every place that they're storing fuel, that they're going to have to set up their own operation to do whatever you have to do to get it into the dry casks? And what would that cost?
Well, a large number of them have already done that. But it has to be dry casks at the plant anyway. Before it's shipped. There's no additional cost.
Even if
that.
It was going to Yucca Mountain, they'd still have to do that.
They still have to do that. You have to set up a concrete pad and ideally berms, earthen berms around it. Looks like that's going to have to be done anyway. So might as well get on with it.
All right. We have some other callers. We'll see if we can get as many in as we can. I'll go to Urbana next, and this is line 4, I believe. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I haven't heard your whole discussion, but I've heard about the last 20 minutes of it, and it has made me remember back when I was a girl that they observed that the sun is a nuclear power plant, and it's about as close to Earth as you'd want a nuclear power plant or nuclear waste. And I just I guess what I'd like to have the authority here speak to is how many years will it be before any of that nuclear waste is broken down or in any way not a potential threat? And I'll just go ahead and sign off.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, as I mentioned, after about 10,000 years, which was a long time, what comes out of a nuclear power plant is less radioactive than the uranium ore that was dug up in the first place to make it. So it is a problem that has to be managed for a very long time. And one should not use nuclear power unless one is willing to accept that burden. On the other hand, every carbon atom we put into the atmosphere also has effects that will last for hundreds of years at least, and maybe longer. The most cost-effective approach to dealing with the whole energy problem is to use energy more efficiently, and that we don't do nearly as well as we could. But even if we get much better at that, which hopefully we're in the process of doing, there will still be the problem of how to deal with the environmental consequences of the energy that we produce, however we produce it.
We'll try to do one more. Terre Haute, line 1. Hello.
Yeah. Hey, I got a question. Why couldn't you send the spent fuel out in space like a capsule, like they did the Voyager thing? I know it's kind of a far-fetched thing, but that's kind of a question of mine. I'll hang up and change the question.
And I think that I don't know if it's serious, but I think from time to time, I guess I've heard that suggestion. Well, yeah, why don't we take it and shoot it into the sun? Could you actually do such a thing?
First of all, it's incredibly expensive to do that compared to putting it in copper and putting it back in a mine where it won't be a problem for a million years or ever. And second, every once in a while, one of those things doesn't get into orbit and breaks up, and that's not a good thing. And so it comes up from time to time. But, you know, the basic problem is that there's no practical way of making this stuff go away forever. You have to set up a system to manage it, and it's essentially a political social organization problem, a technical aspects of it are already worked out.
Yeah. And just real quick, just because someone mentioned the sun Is it reasonable to think that in any reasonable frame of time, we might actually be able to do fusion and generate power that way?
Well, fusion has the same problem that we talked about with pebble bed reactors, except enormously more so. It has a very low power density, extremely expensive, and there does not seem to be any prospects that for any reasonable amount of time, probably never, that fusion will be a viable fuel source, energy source, at least not one that's competitive with the standard way of making nuclear energy, even if you have to get the uranium from seawater.
All right. And the possibility that plan D is going to be someone in Washington is going to take this up and say, okay, this sounds like a pretty good idea. We're going to do that.
Well, it's already gotten a pretty good reception from people who are in decision-making capacity. There will be a Blue Ribbon Commission on Nuclear Waste appointed, which is supposed to report in 2 years, so after the next congressional election. and at that point, we'll see what recommendations they come. We will certainly be giving this to them.
All right. Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580 is Clifford Singer. He's professor in the Department of Nuclear, Plasma, and Radiological Engineering, one of the contributors to this report that we've mentioned, Plan D for Spent Nuclear Fuel. You can read it if you go to the website of the program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security on the U of I campus. Thanks very much.
It was a pleasure being here.